You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The relationship between the United States and China will shape the 21st century, which makes it as important as any bilateral relationship in the world. That really must underpin our partnership. That is the responsibility that together we bear.
That was President Obama speaking yesterday, and today Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner are leading bilateral talks with China on issues like the world financial crisis and the nuclear ambitions of North Korea and Iran. As far as I can tell, China's growing role in the development of many sub-Saharan African countries is not on the agenda. But judging from the findings of Serge Michel and Michel Buret, who traveled the continent for 2 years looking into China's African connections, it probably should be. China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa is published by Nation Books, and it includes a 16-page insert by photojournalist Paolo Woods, who's also traveled the continent extensively. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Serge Michel and Paolo Woods to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
So, Serge, how much money has China invested in China?
Oh, it's very
in Africa.
It's very difficult to say because they are not very transparent with numbers and statistics, but most probably between $50 and $100 billion, and that's a lot if you compare with the World Bank and IMF today's capacities.
Is this a fairly recent development?
It started all in the mid-90s. Because at that time, the West withdrew a bit from Africa. You would see the French and the Americans, British, being a bit discouraged about Africa because of the genocide in Rwanda, but the different failures of their own aid projects led them to believe that Africa was good for nothing. So they withdrew, and that's the time Chinese went in.
Did China show much interest in Africa during the Mao years, or was that just simply a military aid situation?
No, there was a large cooperation, but only based on ideology and friendship among people. At that time, for China, the thing was to prove that they had a better communism than USSR. So the Russians were involved in a few countries and Chinese in others, and they were mostly doing stadiums and friendship things and prestige buildings for African. But that was much more ideology. Today, they have come back, and only for business.
Is China's investment likely to overtake the United States as the largest total in Africa?
It's not very far. I mean, the yearly amount of exchanges is now over $100 billion. And I think America is about 120, so they are going to be first in next year or 2010.
Paolo, does the willingness of many Chinese people to spend long periods away from their home play a role in these African ventures?
I think it does. I mean, the Chinese are ready to do things that many Westerners are not ready to do anymore. So they will go to China to Africa for 3 years in some of the poorest, most dangerous countries in the world, work extremely long hours in very difficult conditions, and not even have vacation at times for long periods, and for a very low pay, relatively very low pay. So yes, that is one of the strong elements of the Chinese.
How is it different from what the United States did with the Peace Corps in some of these areas?
Well, the Peace Corps had a whole ideological part about it. Here, as Serge was saying before, there's no ideology left. The Chinese are not coming to bring communism to Africa. They're coming exclusively through business. They speak about a win-win relationship, but it's not necessarily only that. They come for business.
And also, you know, the Peace Corps, they are very nice people, but they are not so many. So they are not building roads. They are just maybe helping to do some small things, some projects in medicine or education. The Chinese this amazing capacity to send in thousands of workers anywhere, anytime in Africa to make up a dam or build up a highway. And that's not only they pay for the highway or for the railway, but they also send the people to actually build it.
Are they integrating with the local people? I mean, is intermarriage...
Very little. I mean, if you think of Chinese and African culture, it's very difficult to have more distant cultures in the world.
So there's little cultural exchange.
Very little. And despite the official speech of friendship among people and this red carpet treatment that ministers got on both sides, but the thing is that there is very little mixed marriages. And, you know, the Chinese, when they go to Africa, they mostly remain among Chinese. They eat Chinese food made up by Chinese cooks with Chinese vegetables in a Chinese canteen. And they sleep in Chinese barracks. And they don't really like Africans. There is no... they don't go with Africans, their co-workers, after the job to have a beer together.
So that doesn't upset the Africans, who must realize that something like that is insulting.
Sure. It in different places that does create a problem, and they are seen as a very alien force coming, living in their barracks. You can have Chinese stay in Africa for 3 years, not even learning one word of the local language, and does not create integration. This is mainly what we're talking about here. For government projects, so Chinese government, big Chinese corporations going to Africa and working. But you have another element as well, which is the Chinese pioneers. These are people, business people, that leave China to go and start businesses in very risky areas, and they really do get involved. We have the case, for example, of Mr. Wood, Jacob Wood, in Nigeria.
Now, he's Chinese, even though his name is Jacob Wood.
Right. They're usually the business people, because people have a hard time pronouncing originally their Chinese name, they will go and use a local name. Well, he is in Africa for many years. He speaks the local language, has become an advisor to the president of Nigeria, and he's even adopted some of the local habits. So he's become polygamous. He has two wives.
So he has learned the language, unlike others.
He has learned the language, and he has the local Nigerian policemen are his bodyguards.
And in a way, multiple wives is a good business strategy for him, isn't it? Because he can have one wife managing a hotel and one center business, and then the other one can be at another hotel.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, they tend to multiply all the kinds of business. He has at least 16 different businesses, and as you say, his wife, he has one in the capital and one in Lagos, which is the main city.
What do his wives say about this? Did you just get to speak to them?
Yes, we did, especially with one of his wives, Amy. We spent quite a bit of time with her. An amazing person. She has this restaurant she runs, which is a five-story restaurant, 1,500 seats. And we spent an evening there where she was throwing a banquet for the president of the Nigerian Senate and his 300 guests. And she does that as a gesture to then get, you know, favors. And she was not very communicative about the fact that her husband had another wife, but she was very admirative of this man. She came from Canada, where she was living before, to Nigeria to live with him.
In one photo, we see a Chinese technician instructing a Nigerian worker. Are they training the locals to actually take over the jobs, or are they only giving them the most menial work?
This is a big issue. It depends a bit from place to place, but usually the Chinese want to do the work themselves and the qualified work, and they do not train very much. They've often been criticized for that. But in some areas, they do. In this particular photograph, yes, he is training the local worker, and you might notice on the photograph that the Nigerian worker is wearing flip-flops, and he actually is wearing protective shoes. So yes, there is a big difference. But what is interesting is that the supervisor is on the ground in the factory itself, and he is working with him. If he was a Western supervisor, he probably would have been in an air-conditioned office, you know, just pushing buttons. And this is not the case. He lives in the factory, and he works with the people.
My guests are photographer Paolo Woods, who supplied 16 photographs for a book just published in this country called China Safari: On the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa, written by Serge Michel and Michel Beret, and published by Nation Books. And Serge Michel is here as well. Serge, why is the United States allowing itself to be overtaken? Do we and other Western nations feel the opportunities available in Africa aren't worth the trouble and expense?
Well, yeah, somehow. I mean, the fact that there has been an Afro-pessimism, as we say in France, after the Rwandan genocide, and many companies thought it's going to be too expensive, too dangerous. It's also risky because, you know, in Africa you find yourself as a company doing things that your shareholders in a time where there is a high control of what the companies are doing would not really approve. You have this amnesty, you have this WWF supervision of your work that might bring you in trouble. So Africa was a risky place for Western companies.
But France has, of course, had many colonies, still has ties to all of those Francophone countries, perhaps closer ties than the British have to the Anglophone countries that they controlled during the colonial period.
Yeah, but France has gone through a difficult time in Africa. They were behind every single dictator they had in the former.
And supported the Rwandan genocide to some degree, at least prevented the UN from acting on it.
It's a very controversial thing now in France, but it's true that the role France played is not very clear yet. The thing is that they had this very pragmatic approach of helping the local dictator in every place they were, and then a moral approach came also with the help of Washington consensus approach and everything. So they started to be more paternalistic and tell the dictators, you should be a bit more acceptable, presentable. You know, you cannot continue like this to rig elections. And French, after a while, were fed up of this effort, and Africans were fed up of this paternalistic approach. So they welcomed Chinese because Chinese came saying, we have no precondition. We come to do business. We don't care about democracy.
Let's listen to something else from President Obama's speech yesterday in this regard.
And through determined diplomacy, we must meet our responsibility to seek the peaceful resolution of conflict. And that can begin with the renewed push to end the suffering in Darfur and to promote a comprehensive peace in Sudan. All of these issues are rooted in the fact that no one nation can meet the challenges of the 21st century on its own, nor effectively advance its interests in isolation.
Now, the speech mostly was very friendly toward China, but was that one of the more pointed moments, because many people in this country have been upset about the Chinese role or connection to the Sudanese government. There was even a campaign to boycott the Beijing Olympics because of Chinese support of the Sudanese government.
Yeah. Now, sure. What surprised me most, I mean, he was very clever doing the speaking about Darfur in front of Chinese officials. The thing is that a few weeks before, he was in Ghana for this big speech about Africa and America, and he didn't mention even once the word China there. And but he meant a lot. How to say? He spoke about a lot of things as if China was in the subtext, as a subtitle of his speech. And he even praised a local journalist in Ghana called Anas Aremeyaou Anas. And if you look in the internet about him, that's a journalist who has become the journalist of the year in Ghana for a very long investigation and very dangerous investigation about a Chinese prostitution ring in Ghana and Nigeria. So
Nigerian and Ghanaese women?
No, it's Chinese women that are illegally have illegally entered these countries and that are exploited by a Chinese boss the clients are either local or expats.
Now, does the Chinese government care how the rest of the world views its involvement in Africa? Did it adjust at all after all the criticism about its role in Sudan?
They did some efforts for Sudan, but mostly before the Olympics, the Beijing Olympics last summer. For the rest, they don't really care. They have been criticized for their behavior in Zambia, for example, where they had contributed to a very repressive approach by government because the Chinese are having mines, copper mines in Zambia, and they pay very badly and they don't respect any security measures. So they had a big accident with 50 people dying, 50 Zambians, and they didn't compensate the families well. They messed a bit the follow-up of the accident. And now you have strikes, anti-Chinese strikes in Zambia on a regular basis. And the government, of course, was on the Chinese side, and they crushed the strikes. They killed even more people. And China doesn't seem to be very sensitive to this.
This is interesting because at times you find that the Chinese are operating in countries which are more democratic than what they are. The press in Zambia is a freer press than what the press is in China. So they were unused to have criticism from the opposition. And actually the opposition in Zambia, which almost won the elections, that is talk about rigging there, had campaigned on the Chinese invasion, let's say.
My guests are Paolo Woods, who is an award-winning photographer. His work is regularly published in Time, Newsweek, Le Monde, Geo, and other international publications. He's here with Serge Michel, who was until recently West Africa correspondent for Le Monde. And he is co-author with Michel Beret of a book called China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa. It is published by Nation Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Serge Michel, who with Michel Beret has written China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa, published by Nation Books. Also with us is photographer Paolo Woods. 16 of his wonderful photographs are included in the book. A listener points out that in the past, China used to send workers to help out in different places like Egypt to shore up the banks of the Nile, but that's because they worked very inexpensively. Now we're seeing something quite different. Are we seeing a kind of a new colonial approach?
Well, it's very controversial. Yes, there is a colonial scheme in that. Is that the China is extracting raw materials from Africa and is manufacturing these goods in China and then re-exporting it to Africa, which
is that's the colonial model.
Exactly. But on the other hand, they don't want to rule Africa. I mean, they are very clear about this, and they don't want to interfere. So they all they do is to help local rulers, might they be dictators or democracy elected. If they need elections, by the way, if these African rulers needs to be re-elected, China will help. They provide them with projects, concrete things that they have done for them, and then these rulers can tell their electorate, look what I've done. I've done a highway, I've done a power station, and it helps a lot. And most of the Chinese projects in this case are time-related with the elections. So.
Well, Paolo, one of your photographs shows a member of the China International Fund working with an Angolan to repair a road through landmine territory.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fund something that we don't hear very much about? Because the Chinese don't have a reputation for doing much relief work in Africa.
Well, this here is not relief work. This is they're constructing a road in one of the most mined countries in the world that came out of more than 20-year civil war. But they're not doing this to be nice. This is not charity.
So this is not a good works thing, like the NGOs.
No, this is business. What they do, they build this road, and then they get paid in Africans' oil. So this is something that has nothing to do with charity.
Now, I'm sure there are some other countries, or at least companies in other countries, that would like some of these jobs. Do the Chinese outbid them?
Yes, they do. They do outbid even African companies. They are very cheap. Sometimes we've been confronted to examples where the Chinese price for a tender was not even worth the materials they would use.
So why do this? Just simply to get a foot in?
They want at a loss. They don't want to make money on every project. They just want to get in Africa.
You're right about the Japanese section of the new highway project in Algeria. How are the Japanese working to keep up with the Chinese sections?
Yeah, they had to. This project was an amazing one. It's 1,000 kilometers long highway all across Algeria. And the tenders were won. I mean, there were three sections, and the Chinese won two, and Japanese won one. And to keep up with the Chinese capacity to send in about 12,000 workers to do the work, the Japanese had to be very technology oriented. They have bulldozers that are guided by satellite, and when they take some square meters of soil, they tell the satellite how much soil it is, so they can prepare the trucks behind. And every engine they have on the working site is guided through computer. So only high technology can beat the Chinese.
And have we seen other people try similar approaches? Obviously, most African companies couldn't compete with them that way.
No. Well, you have Brazilian companies competing in Portuguese-speaking countries like Angola, but mainly the big projects today in Africa are done by Chinese companies. They are the ones that are able and willing to go in and do massive construction projects that many of the Western companies are just too expensive for today.
And now we're seeing a situation where there's pressure to divest in companies that do business in many of these African countries, and also in Chinese companies that are doing business there. Is that economic pressure having any effect?
I don't think on the short term, because basically many of these companies are not exactly private companies. They're state-run companies. And as we know, China has a lot of cash, a lot of American cash as well, to be able to sponsor these companies. So their idea is to go into Africa, and as you said before, get a foot in and become one of the big players there. And then they will have access to raw materials. Their real aim is to have access to raw materials that fuel their amazing growth.
But you're suggesting that they are a big player. They're number two right now?
Destined
to be number one soon?
They took over France last year, yeah.
And I guess they passed Britain sometime in the past.
Yes.
So the United States is the only real competition right now?
Yeah, but it's a competition not in Africa for companies who work there. It's a theoretical competition, because these figures show how much oil is bought, how much exchanges take place between the two places. So I think America will be overtaken very soon.
And don't you also suggest that often the numbers are fudged, so it's hard to really know?
It's very hard to know. The Chinese are very secretive. You know, as a journalist, we've been working in Afghanistan, in Iraq. We've been interviewing Taliban and Fallujah guerrilla chiefs there. But we never had so much difficulty to access the thing like in Africa. The Chinese believe every journalist is a spy, and they are not used to speak with the press. They don't want to open the factories. They don't want to open the mines. And they are very difficult people to communicate.
And what does that mean for a photographer? Because a reporter might be able to do some work without being noticed.
Well, that's really the point. When we decided to do this book, we decided we didn't want to be sitting in an office looking at statistics and numbers. We wanted to be on the ground with the Chinese. And so this has probably been our hardest assignment, and I'm pretty happy we did get a lot of access. When I've been researching before, both on the image side and the tech side, there was very little on the Chinese in Africa. And when there was, it never really was with the Chinese. We wanted to spend time with them. We wanted to go in their karaoke bars and sing with them all night. We went into the forest where they're logging the forest in Congo.
You show them building their prefabricated housing.
Exactly. That is in Algeria. We even were in China meeting Chinese getting ready to leave for Africa. So it has been very difficult. For example, in places like Zambia, we were there over a month, and the first 3 weeks, I didn't even take one photograph, because the 3 weeks we had been building up access. And finally, we did get access. We did go into the mines and all that, and we are one of the very few Western journalists that did get access to that.
And then
it was almost impossible.
And then we were expelled very rudely from the mine.
My guests are Serge Michel, who with Michel Bourret has written China Safari on the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa. And also with us is photojournalist Paolo Woods, who supplied the photos and I suspect did some of the journalism.
You
know the story quite well. The book is published by Nation Books, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate.
Well, yes, we with Serge, we've been working together from over 10 years, and we've always really wanted to work on a blend between text and images. We do not think that the images illustrate the text, or that the text is a caption for the image. It's the two sides of journalism that, when they get together, bring a stronger view for who's reading and who's looking.
The book begins with the China-African Summit in Beijing in 2006, and it's a kind of bizarre ceremony at times where these African leaders paid respects to the Chinese president, Hu Jintao. So how much of this is economic and how much of it is political?
It's very difficult to say, but it's very symbolic, the whole thing. I mean, there were 48 African leaders there, head of governments or head of states, and they've been treated by Chinese like they have never been in the West. You know, they're red carpets all the way, limousine service, very good hotels, and they've been so impressed. You know, when you go now to Beijing, it's such an impressive city. It's some parts of the city looks like Manhattan with skyscrapers. Other side looks very traditional, and the Chinese have really made their best to impress these African guests.
And as you said earlier, they don't throw words like corruption.
And the whole press conference, for example, that took place at the end of the summit, there was no information really. The Chinese said, okay, we'll double the help for Africa, but they didn't say which amount they will double. So it was really a smoke screen. We went to the summit to witness this kind of display of politeness and red carpet and everything. But then the real work began soon after when we went on the ground in Africa.
Are there any African countries that don't welcome business with the Chinese?
Well, there are five countries that are still with Taiwan, so they cannot be with both. They have to choose between Beijing and Taiwan. And there is Libya. Colonel Gaddafi is personally, I don't know why, but he's very anti-Chinese himself. And there are some countries, and that's more interesting, who have been with the Chinese for the last 10 years and who now understand that it's not a very equal and that they're not very reliable partners. So, for example, Zambia, the anti-Chinese feeling is very high. In Angola as well, there are some tensions between the government and Beijing. So there are places, I think, where Chinese have gone and they will have to withdraw. So they will have somehow, they went so fast. You know, in the last 10 years, they went to, I don't know, 48 countries altogether. And how can one country manage that? You know, can you imagine the map room in Beijing with the 48 countries and have flags and see what they do in every place? It's an amazing system that China has put forward to invade Africa.
And as you point out, the countries that do business with the Chinese receive jolts to their economy, although I guess something that I've been circling around is how much of it winds up in the pockets of some of the leaders of these countries. And what happens when, in a place like Gabon, when the Chinese companies are permitted to mine and the national parks, which supposedly are not to be touched?
Yeah. Well, about corruption, I think the West has no lessons to give because they have fed the corrupted system in Africa for years. But then when Chinese come in, they also have no lessons to learn because China is itself quite a corrupted place. So they are used to give money under the table. And if there is one good thing about the Chinese way, Chinese approach in Africa, is that as they finance projects and they do it themselves, there is less money spent to facilitate the tenders. You know, they somehow,
they're not giving bribes as much as
they
did
in
the past.
They get the money back themselves because they work for the you know, they pay $300 million for a dam and then they build the dam, so they cannot really increase the money and grease the hands.
What was happening before, you often saw that Western countries would go in, pay money on a Swiss account to some dictator, and then get access to the raw materials. The Chinese said, we come in and we'll give you, instead of giving you cash, we'll build something for you. So we'll build a dam, we'll build a road. And there definitely is money going and lining pockets of African elite. But at the end, the African people do get a dam that creates electricity, do get a road, do get some infrastructure that they very badly need.
But the local workers don't get very much. One of your photos shows a group of workers who make $4 a day and spend half on food and transport at the job.
Right, this is in Congo, and they are very unhappy. They don't have a contract. They are paid on a daily basis. They're not insured. They complain of being beaten by their Chinese bosses. So and the money they're getting actually is lower than the national wage they're supposed to be paid. But this is on a government project, so that's the irony of it all. But yes, the Chinese, if they're allowed to pay little, will pay little.
Well, in the past, the United States was there doing similar things, and resentments built up. Mm-hmm. You think the same sort of thing is going to happen with the Chinese?
Resentment is building up, and we see that in different countries. The problem is that the resentment usually is building up in the lower classes, in the classes that have less voice, and the higher classes, the rulers, are the ones instead that continue to be very enthusiastic about the Chinese, because the Chinese are doing the work that they should be doing, creating infrastructure for their own country.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today. I've been talking with Paolo Woods, who is a photographer who has who tries to work on long-term projects rather than just parachuting into a place and taking a bunch of pictures.
Indeed.
And then going somewhere else. And his work is regularly published in publications like Time, Newsweek, Le Monde, Geo. Also with us is Serge Michel, who was until recently West African correspondent for the French newspaper Le Monde. He has worked in Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, as you pointed out earlier, the Balkans, but a lot in Africa. And he is a collaborator with Michel Bure on a book called China Safari, On the Trail of Beijing's Expansion in Africa. It is published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.